This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today we're talking about life expectancy. A new report from the CDC says life expectancy for a typical American has decreased by a full year during the pandemic. But what does that mean? How do we measure life expectancy, and what can it tell us about the communities we live in? We're joined now by Farah Yusri, a health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media. Welcome to the show, Farah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the headline to your recent story was Black Americans face widening life expectancy gap, biggest since 1998. Can you talk about what you learned doing this piece?
Yeah, so the CDC issues an annual report showing trends in life expectancy. For 2020, they released the data for the first half of the year, and they noticed that the life expectancy of Americans, like you said, overall fell an entire year, and that's the lowest it's been since 2006. Another troubling finding is that this decrease in life expectancy did not affect everyone equally. So Black Americans saw the biggest drop in life expectancy, followed by Hispanic Americans. It's also important to point out that this data from the CDC is preliminary and might change when the rest of the year's deaths are accounted for. But all the experts I spoke with say that the racial disparities are likely to stay.
And what were some of the things that came up as you were reporting on this? Anything new things that you learned?
So to put things in perspective, according to this CDC report, there's a 6-year gap in how long Black Americans live compared to white Americans. And that's the biggest gap since 1998. So basically over 20 years of progress has been erased in the first half of 2020. So many questions pop up as I report this story. Why? Why is that happening? Is it because of the pandemic and how more exposed Black Americans are given their essential jobs and living conditions? Or is it the higher rates of chronic health conditions Black Americans struggle with that make them at a higher risk if they catch COVID? Or maybe it's not directly COVID-19, but issues related to it, such as the economic distress, increase in the overdose deaths, for example, delayed medical care, and so on. So there are so many unanswered questions as we report this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as you said, that the 20 years of progress have been erased, that something like an alarm bell goes off, like what is causing this?
Exactly.
So as you're digging into this story, you know, there's disparities in life expectancy, and things can get kind of complicated as you try to dig into the data. How do you approach this topic and turn it into something that listeners can understand?
You're right. It's a very complex and interrelated story in so many ways. And it's almost impossible to point to one thing and say, yeah, this is why the disparity exists. You know, the human brain is very happy when it can find cause and effect. But I have to remind myself every day that I'm not going to find that while covering this story. And I feel one way to approach this story is to take it step by step and discuss one issue at a time. And most importantly, to talk to the people who are living this situation day in and day out, because it's in the daily lives of people that you find the most valuable clues.
Mm-hmm. And so you're planning a series of stories about this. Can you tell us what you're planning for this series and what you're looking into?
So in Indianapolis, the disparity in life expectancy is relatively big. You look at the metro area, there's as much as 14 years difference in how long people live depending on their zip code. So we are granted a national fellowship by the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the Commonwealth Fund to work on a year-long project to tell stories from the community in Indianapolis, basically to explore the reasons this disparity in life expectancy exists. And there are really lifelong problems affecting the Black community from when they are newborn babies until they're well into adulthood. So we hope we can capture some of that in our reporting.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Farah, for joining us. We definitely are looking forward to learning more about the series and hopefully talking with you more about all of this. Farah Yusri is a health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media. You can follow her work on life expectancy and other health issues at sideeffectspublicmedia.org. We're going to listen now to an interview I had this morning with Tess Weathers, a research associate at IU's Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health, who's been studying life expectancy and disparities in central Indiana. So, Tess, I know that you're a social epidemiologist. Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
Yeah, so I think a lot of listeners have heard about epidemiology in the last year because they think primarily about epidemiologists as being people who sort of track disease spread through populations when we're talking about things like viruses and COVID. Mm-hmm. But my particular branch of epidemiology, which is called social epidemiology, looks more at social conditions that either promote or hinder or help in the spread and control of disease. So I'm far more interested in things like segregation and poverty and those sorts of social conditions.
Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely get into that in a minute. I want to know a little bit about the research you did on life expectancy in Indianapolis in 2015. What were some of the things that you found back then? I mean, that already seems like a long time ago.
Right, it does. And of course, we're working on an update. But the things that we found, on the one hand, did not surprise me, but I think that they surprised a lot of people and brought a consciousness to the inequities that we have right here in the Indianapolis metro area. I had seen these maps. In fact, the one that inspired me was a map of the Washington, D.C. area, where it showed, based on if you took their metro system from the center of town and you took it on the red line or the green line or the blue line, how different the life expectancy was on the other end. And it just got me curious, basically. I thought, does that happen here? Is that same pattern of inequity present in our own city? And so, you know, I set about to do the work, mostly out of both my long-held interest in health disparities, but in curiosity. And so when we did this work back in 2015, we combined 5 years of death data to look at life expectancy across the 104 zip codes of the 11 county metro area. And we found more than a 14-year difference in communities, the lowest and the highest living communities across the metro area. And when I first saw the results on a map, I think I did what many people do. My eyes went searching for where I live, right? Like, and somehow the impact of that information was very different. It was almost like a gut punch, because it's different when you see it in another city and then when you see it for your own city and your own home address. It causes you to think more about, why would that be? Why would it be that a community, literally two communities that share a street boundary, would be so different in terms of their life opportunities? So that's sort of the thing in a nutshell. And I think it really, I guess, just brought the inequities really home for me. And yeah.
And to explain to our listeners what these inequities are, I mean, some people are aware of this research that's been done, you know, all over the country, but can you kind of break it down for us?
Yeah. So using life expectancy, I know some people really get kind of confused about that term. What does that really mean? And the one that we normally report is life expectancy at birth. So it's basically saying, if the people who live in this area continue to die at the same age and at the same rate that they have been, this is how long a baby born today would be expected to live in this area. And it's an average number. So one misconception a lot of people will come up with is they'll say, oh, you know, if you tell me my life expectancy in my area is 69, well, okay, you know, that's not great, but it's okay. I'm just going to lose 14 years off the end. It doesn't work that way. It's an average, right? So what you see when a life expectancy in a given area, really, if that's low, it's reflecting lost years of potential life across the entire lifespan. And in fact, the more number, the higher infant mortality is, for example, the more that number is going to drop. Deaths at, you know, among adolescents is going to really pull that number down. So it's a misconception to think that if I tell you 69, everybody lives to 69 and then they die. It's a spread of lost life across the entire span. And I don't know if that gets to your question. I'm sure there's more I need to address there, if you can remind me.
Well, I guess also I'm thinking about how the pandemic has impacted life expectancy, and if it was expected that these certain zip codes where they've already been seeing lower life expectancy, if it's the same thing with the pandemic, where it's like these are the areas and the communities where they're going to be hardest hit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. When the CDC released their preliminary estimates for 2020, I was sadly not surprised at all. Because what, not only in COVID, but in every other major crisis practically you can think of, whether it's a natural disaster or a previously unforeseen virus, these communities basically with low life expectancy are going into any challenge with less reserve, less resources, less capacity to mount a response to that challenge and come out the other end unscathed, right? So I think there is generally a very strong correlation between what a community's prior life expectancy was and the amount of burden that they've taken on during COVID. And of course, those numbers showed that, of course, we all lost life expectancy across the board. Well, at least in a some number, I'm sure that some communities did not. But the African-American community, Latino communities really took much greater hit than did white communities.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Tess Weathers, a research associate at IU's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We'll be back after a quick break with a local organizer working to improve the quality of life for people in Indianapolis. If you have any questions or comments, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soh. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking today about life expectancy changes during the pandemic and the disparities revealed by life expectancy research across different zip codes. We're joined now by Ronald Rice, a community networker for the Northwest Side of Indianapolis. Welcome, Ronald.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with, if you could just tell us a little bit about what you do in Indianapolis and the groups that you work with.
Sure. So I'm the community builder for the Near Northwest of Life Programs. And so our main focus is to try to find ways to improve the quality of life of all the residents that are within it. The Near Northwest is pretty large, going from 16th Street to 38th Street, the 65 corridor all the way to Kessler Boulevard, and seven neighborhoods within that that area. So we do that by following some of the resident-driven plans of improving life in housing, food access, arts, parks, and public spaces, education, and peace and safety and economic development. And then I also am the community health worker for the DIPIN project. It's a diabetes awareness and prevention and a community engagement program funded by Lilly and ran through the IU School of Public Health. And my job there is to basically try to find ways to it's resident-driven also, and so I kind of help coordinate and find ways to get more people active in their own diabetic health, and those who are who don't know if they're diabetic or not, find ways to make sure that they are getting the information and the testing needed to make that happen. So
it sounds like you've got a lot of different things that kind of work together in a way when we're talking about this topic today, specifically when we're talking about life expectancy. How does that factor into the work that you do?
It factors in a lot. I was listening to your previous guest, and I've actually talked to Farah, and I believe I work with Tess with the Diabetes Project also. But every day I'm seeing the results of what a poorer quality of life is doing has an effect on our life expectancy. When we don't have good roads, for instance, and where your wealthier neighborhoods will have them, where we don't have the investments in the parks in our parks in our area where other neighborhoods would have them, what would encourage us to want to go out and exercise? I told Farrah before, a lot of times I'll drive through some of the wealthier neighborhoods just to see the number of people who are outside on a daily basis, walking their dogs, walking with their kids, walking with their loved ones. They don't have to worry about the things that people have to worry about on this side of town. There's more wealth, there's more wealth building, there's a lot more security, so they can spend the time focusing on their health. Where here, people are worried about if they'll have a job, can they pay their rent, can they put food on the table? So you're not thinking about going outside to go work out. And this is just one example, but you're not thinking about going outside to go work out. You're not thinking about making healthier food choices. You're making the choices that you can make. And then you've got issues with food access, not only just food deserts, but also transportation to get into those places. And when the pandemic hit, and there was a lockdown, that cut off, obviously, a lot of transportation, people going anywhere. And so the people who didn't have anything beforehand, it was even worse for them. So it became a hurdle to try to find those folk in this huge area to try to address those needs. And even when we did that, we had to worry also about the food that was being given. And God bless everyone who gave us donations and whatnot. But then when you have a high amount of diabetes and hypertension, and then a lot of the food was high in sodium, high in sugar and whatnot, we had to start separating a lot of that food for our seniors in particular to make sure that we're not adding to bad health for them. So.
And you're talking about food, and that just makes me think of, I was having a conversation recently with someone just about food deserts and how, in the pandemic, it's pretty difficult if you're in a stay-at-home order and the only thing in your area might be, if you're lucky, like a gas station with a convenience store. And so those are the food options that you have in the limited area that you are in. Is that something that you're seeing a lot of, like food deserts, and is that issue being addressed?
Yeah. So yes, and this was we used to have the nearest stores were a couple of miles away. And again, we have a really high senior population here. And so Finer House, our community center here in the area, stepped up 2 years ago and built Cleo's Bodega right there on Finer House's property on a major artery. It's a grocery store or a bodega, which is kind of a small grocery store and a cafe. So it gave people, once we people were allowed to come back out again, gave people an option to get over right there in their own neighborhood and get to the grocery store to buy food or buy their essentials, even just to sit down and, kind of get away from the isolation that everyone was going through, because we do have an outside patio there. But it was something that wasn't in the neighborhood before. And because of the work from the residents, the quality of life plan, Flanner House, that's now there, and it's become kind of an oasis in the desert in a way.
I know we also, you mentioned earlier about folks who are worried about, finding a job or being able to pay rent or put food on the table. And these are some of the things that you see in some communities, whereas it sounds like, other communities are in a bubble. They're just living their lives, not realizing that just, a few blocks away, someone else is not able to go out for a walk. How does this impact life expectancy? Is stress a huge factor?
Stress is a very big factor. A lot of times with different organizations that we work with, we talk about ways to change the trajectories that we've been going through. And, a lot of folks' success is having two jobs or, getting a night shift job, which, night shift jobs do have an impact on your health because, it's messing with your natural sleep cycle. Having two jobs is wearing you down when you get home, and then you have to try to fit everything that you have to do in your home life in a very small amount of time so you can get sleep to go back to those two jobs, which is putting wear and tear on your body. So, yeah, it does. And then when you have only like you were saying before, just a gas station here or whatnot, the food choices are not good. And then what they do, what you'll see a lot more of would be cigarettes, liquor, high processed foods, high sodium foods, which affects your hypertension, affects your diabetes, which we already have a high diabetes rate in African American culture. So, you know, that worrying about all those things, worrying about being able to feed someone. In fact, even during the pandemic, it was a really big deal. The reason why we started to mobilize and start to get food out to folks was because we have almost all public schools in this area. And a lot of those kids depend, and those families depend on the kids eating at the school. So when the schools were closed, there was no breakfast or lunch for them. And so we made it a point of making sure that we work with the schools to get a list of those kids who had those needs, and we got that food out to them with collaborations with Planter House and also with Indigo, who was a huge help, giving us buses to deliver the food out to those folks. So, yeah, stress is a huge factor, and I can't imagine if we went through another lockdown like we did, like how much more of a huge effect on our life expectancy it's going to have.
Well, speaking about the pandemic, you know, we've heard a lot over the last year that, you know, experts are saying this has finally highlighted inequities that have existed for a long time. Do you think that that is true? Have we seen more, I guess, awareness, conversations around inequity?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, it was funny. Within the first month, I think anybody and everybody, and no matter where you were in the city, if you were going out to help, in particular, I bring up food again just because that was kind of like the hot button topic for during the pandemic. But in the first month, when I went out to go and deliver some food to someone and I saw maybe three or four kids and they had absolutely no food at all, it wasn't, you know, in those first couple of weeks, people weren't getting laid off. So it wasn't that they were suffering from the loss of a job that was affecting, you know, how much food they were able to bring in. It was actually going to these houses and actually seeing that they were already in need. So, yeah, it absolutely put a spotlight on what was already a problem and that we should have been dealing with this a lot sooner rather than later. The pandemic really put a light on everything.
Do you think there's going to be some positive change coming out of this, or is it one of these things where everybody got really mobilized and then as patterns start going back to normal, people start getting back to work, getting the vaccine, that this will be forgotten?
I think the work, in fact, I know the work has already started. Like I said, I think for a lot of folks, especially the ones that I work with, they became very aware of the need to start focusing a lot more on health and also all the different social determinants of health. So it wasn't just about food anymore. It was also about, you know, access to or transportation. It was all, it became about getting more programs or more or cleaning up and beautifying our spaces so that it become more attractive so people can get out and move around more. It became about, you know, communication and people finding out there was rental assistance or utility assistance, you know, in particular with Planter House and a lot of other organizations that were in the area. It became a lot about getting up and talking to our neighbors and checking on them. And for our organizations, our stakeholders that we partner with, who got a lot more involved, they always were, but they became even more involved with engaging the community and working with them, not as a savior, but as an empathetic neighbor. And that became one of the most beautiful things about this pandemic was the way that everyone, and especially in my area, coalesced or got together and started to help each other out.
You mentioned a little bit about sort of these issues around access, some of the health issues. And I'm starting to think a little bit about the vaccine and how it became for the COVID-19 vaccine, how it became sort of like this golden ticket everybody was trying to get access to. Have you seen that it's been a lot harder in certain communities to get access to this vaccine? And is there anything being done if that is the case?
Yeah. So there is. We've got IU Health has been a beautiful partner with us and trying to find ways to get more folks to get the vaccine. Planter House has been trying to find, and even Indy Parks has been trying to find ways to get that vaccine into our community or get people from our community to there. The biggest places I've seen have been in our senior living facilities, where, you know, everyone can't drive. Some people are bedridden. Some people are using walkers or they're cut off from communication. So I run a newsletter I try to put that information into the letters that the newsletters that go out to everyone's home. But then also, you know, we try to make visits in each one of the places to let them know that there's help available. The communication, I think, has always been an issue. There is always going to be a resource out there. But it's a matter of how do we get to those folks. It was through the churches a lot, but then the churches were closed down. So, you lost that medium of getting information out there. So, you know, we're doing everything that we can through our meetings, through our visitations, through any events and any programs, through all the buildings that have been open that receive a lot of folks. We try to get information to those places so that they are, people are well armed and can make those connections.
If you have any questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a digital voice message with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. So what about when we talk about things like inequity and the pandemic and all of these different issues, is there anything that isn't visible, like it isn't obvious to somebody to see it's something that's more hidden that you know, you could share with us?
I feel like I should have something on the top of my head. I can't quite think of it right now. I think I kind of said it earlier, the fact that people have to make choices that, you know, a lot of people with more wealth don't have to make. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the underlying issue amongst all of that. You know, it's, you know, we can talk about access all day, we can talk about communication all day, but the fact of the matter is, if I am living paycheck to paycheck, if I am struggling to find a job, if I have something on my record or anything of that nature, those things are going to affect how I am able to provide for my family, which is going to create all kinds of stresses. And that I think that we have got to get to a point, even amongst the world of nonprofits, to stop using hot button items or what the popular thing to do is right now, and really speak to our residents and walk in their shoes and actually look at how they're looking at life. And before we actually start to, you know, provide help, I think everyone's really quick to just throw money on an organization or a neighborhood, or they're quick to, you know, go on social media and talk about all the things they've done, but they're not looking at, is it actually having an effect? Are we actually arming them? Are we empowering them? Instead, right. are we just enabling? And I think those are some of the things that I would like all organizations, nonprofit or for-profit, to look at when they address anything that has to do with a neighborhood that may be struggling.
And what are you and your groups thinking about most right now? What are you planning as you look ahead to the quote-unquote new normal?
Definitely people getting back together. I think everyone's been missing being around each other. That has been a really big deal. Our culture is very... the African American culture is they're very family oriented. They're very much want to be around each other. Not having that, or that fear that something may happen to you, or you may, you know, cause something harm to someone else through this virus or whatever, has been obviously a huge roadblock. I would say, I think one of the things, like we're doing with the Dip-In, for instance, we did a huge push, and we're doing a huge push on making physical activity not only accessible, but we're making it free, and we're trying to get more people out and moving. So we started a lot of programs that the community asked for, so like a hip hop step aerobics program, a kangaroo jumping class for our kids. We do walks, diabetes walks with a lot of our senior folks. So we're trying to do a lot more in that realm to get more people out to enjoy the parks. We have, you know, the third largest regional park in the country that's in an urban area. And so we want to get more people involved in the community process, but also to get out there with their families and enjoy life, enjoy being around each other, as opposed to being behind a screen are locked in your house for a whole year.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate hearing all of the work that you're doing, and we look forward to keeping in touch. Ronald Rice is a community networker for the Northwest side of Indianapolis. We'll be back after a quick break, and we'll delve into the 1918 influenza pandemic and find out how health disparities looked back then. I'm Miriam So, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. With us now to talk about the 1918 flu pandemic and to find out how health disparities looked back then is Elizabeth Wrigley Field, a sociologist at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, nice to be here.
So let's talk about a little bit about the stuff that you study around pandemics and life expectancy and inequity. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your research is and what you look into?
Sure. So I'm a mortality demographer. I study population patterns in death, and I've particularly focused on the 1900 to 1950 period and on infectious disease. So the 1918 flu is one of my big topics. And more recently, I've also focused on COVID mortality. Like a lot of other researchers, I made a kind of a major swerve in the last year to study the pandemic as it's been unfolding.
Well, earlier in the pandemic, we've heard that there have been a lot of comparisons with this 1918 flu pandemic. We're about a year into our own pandemic right now. How useful are these kinds of comparisons?
Well, it's a mixed bag. So there's a lot of things about 1918 that would be very familiar to us today. One is just the scale of the crisis and the way that it upended daily life. And also some of the ways that that was really controversial, I think, would be very familiar to us. So there were huge debates about whether to close schools, theaters, church services. Those things were often enacted by city governments, but were incredibly contentious. There was a lot of pushback against them. And because of that, those restrictions would often be eased up sooner than health experts would say was advisable. So a lot of this kind of thing, you would feel like, yeah, I can recognize those kinds of debates. There's a quote that I love from a Topeka, Kansas newspaper about this that says, you know, both the health commissioner and the health officer have been the target for gobs of criticism and insubordination against the autocracy they were establishing and depriving the citizens of the right to mingle with flu germs. Right. And, you know, it's sort of dripping with sarcasm, but it is reflecting this intense debate about what is legitimate to do to try to stop a respiratory pandemic from spreading throughout your population. And so in that sense, this is really the historical analog that I think is the closest fit for us to learn from. There's some other things that are very different. And the story about racial disparities is a kind of obvious one that comes to mind. But so is the story about age. Right. So there's some real senses in which who was affected by this pandemic are very different from COVID.
I'm curious to know then, now that you brought that up. So what were these differences in 1918 in terms of, you said, age? Who were the people that were most affected?
So 1918 is really different from almost every other flu virus, which is the flu always really affects very young people, infants and young children, and also very old people. And that was true in 1918. But in addition to that, the people who were really affected were people in their 20s and 30s. And that's pretty unprecedented. It is very different from COVID, which is incredibly sensitive to age. So you can predict very well someone's COVID risk by how old they are, in this way that it's just sort of increasing the older someone gets. That's really, in 1918, it was very distinctive. We often describe the typical pattern of mortality risk as a J curve. So you can think about a kind of J that's tilted a little bit, where you've got this big risk at young ages, and then it declines. And then there's this kind of shooting up at the high end. And if that's a J, 1918 is more like a W, where you've got high, young, and old ages, but then this big spike in the middle. And there's really nothing else that looks like that.
And you also mentioned about, you know, this, it seems like there's a history of people not trusting health officials. I think earlier when I was hearing things about the 1918 1918 flu pandemic. Nobody really talked about there was controversy too then. And so I'm wondering, were there any lessons learned in that pandemic? For example, lifting of things earlier than health officials, said was necessary. Did they learn lessons from that? Is that something we should be looking at?
I think so. I mean, I think the lessons are pretty clear. There's a few different attempts to look systematically at comparing across cities based on what kinds of measures they took to prevent the 1918 flu virus from spreading. And cities that took more aggressive measures had fewer deaths than you would predict for those cities. And that pattern is pretty clear. But it's also not as big a difference as you might think it would be. And the experts who've studied this think that that's because there was no city that really maintained the shutdowns for as long as they should have. So the mayors and governors who agreed to do things like school closures, theater closures, limiting church services, they came in for just a relentless attack from business communities in particular, also in some case from churches who wanted to be able to hold in-person services. And they were, in general, only willing to resist that pressure for relatively short periods of time. And that really did have an impact.
Would you be able to, through the data, be able to say that, you know, this many deaths would have been avoided if in 1918 they had been stricter for a longer period of time?
You know, you might be able to model that. It's a little bit challenging because part of the thing about infectious diseases is that their spread it has a multiplying effect, right? And so as you allow more unchecked spread, then you have more people in the population who are infecting other people. So the studies about this, which are by people like a wonderful infectious disease researcher like Mark Lipsitch, I think they have attempted to estimate how many more lives could have been saved with more aggressive measures. But all of those kinds of numbers are always sort of you want to take with a grain of salt, I think.
When it comes to life expectancy as a tool to measure things, how useful is it? And what does it reveal when we're talking about, changing things in communities to ensure that everybody has equity and access?
My internet went out, so I missed the first part of the question. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. That's the way the world works these days. You could just fill in the blank with whatever you think I said. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how useful is using life expectancy as this tool or metric, and how does it, I guess, in the long term, help with navigating situations of inequity and access?
Got it. Well, life expectancy is sort of a double-edged sword. We use it all the time. It's our go-to metric for making quick and easy mortality comparisons across different contexts. So like comparing one country to another, or one time point to another, or one racial group to another. And what is really helpful about it is that it summarizes what's happening to everybody in just one number, and that lets you do a lot of comparisons at once. So that's important. What's not great about life expectancy is that it can be hard to interpret. And that's for two reasons. One is that it's giving you an average lifespan, but we're not always great at thinking about what averages mean. So when somebody dies at a young age, let's say they die as a child. If they hadn't died then, they might have many decades, maybe even a century more of life ahead of them. And so that death is going to change the average kind of a lot. Whereas if someone dies when they're at an older age, 60 or 70, they would not have had so many years of life left, even if they hadn't died then. And their death doesn't have as big an impact on the average. So the result of that is that life expectancy is incredibly sensitive to deaths that happen at young ages. And that's not a problem if you're used to interpreting it. Right. So for professionals, we just sort of know to correct for that. We can picture what we're talking about. But I think that sometimes in public communication, it can be a little misleading. So like if you hear that a population has a life expectancy of 50, you think, wow, they probably don't have a lot of 70-year-olds in that population. That would be really old. And that's actually not true. A population with a life expectancy of 50, which is about the situation in the U.S. right before the 1918 pandemic, that would be a society where plenty of people would live into their 70s, but a lot of kids would be dying in infancy or early childhood, and that's why the life expectancy would be so low.
Oh, that's interesting. I never realized that. I'm just thinking about how sometimes we'll hear, you know, life expectancy back in the day, people only lived till they were 30, and now we're living longer. But then sometimes I feel like I hear the opposite, where it's like, no, they lived longer then, but we're not living as long because we're having so many health problems. So it's just kind of interesting to kind of understand what exactly that means. So what did life expectancy, you mentioned before the flu pandemic of 1918, it was about 50 was the average age. What was causing that?
So the life expectancy back then, the main things that people died of were infectious disease, and those often killed infants and young children. So some of the big killers were flu and pneumonia, even before the 1918 pandemic. People frequently died of flu. Tuberculosis was a very major killer. That was especially true for African Americans, and it had an enormous amount to do with the conditions of life that were forced on Black migrants to cities, who were forced both by law and by violence to live in these intensely segregated and very crowded and dangerous conditions that were very conducive to tuberculosis. There was also more waterborne disease than there is now. This is a period of time where sewage systems were being implemented and water treatment systems were being implemented in cities, but they weren't yet universal. And so you can imagine people living crowded together in a city without a great water treatment system. Like, that's just not a very healthy context. So those are the kinds of things that people might be dying of.
Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. So was there research and understanding back in those days that these were things that were having an effect on life expectancy? Or is this stuff that is usually decades later when you look back at what was happening at that time?
People definitely understood that infectious diseases were the main drivers of mortality, the main things that were killing people. And so a lot of public health movements really arose in this period. And they came about as ways to combat infectious disease usually. And so there was, some of those were really good things, like, you know, let's make sure that companies are not dumping all this waste into the river anymore. That's a great thing to do. Some of them were not so great, like some organized public health efforts of that time were basically like, let's harass immigrant mothers to have them be parents in a way that looks more like the dominant culture. And that was not particularly helpful for making anybody healthier. But the things that really mattered, I think, were just improved living conditions. Some of the labor struggles of that era mattered a lot. If you think about what it would have been like to work in these incredibly dirty factories with very little, running on coal-fired plants, very little effort to clean that up, working long hours, children working, you know, these are conditions where it kind of makes sense that people died at a young age, and starting to challenge some of that matters.
We were talking earlier in this program about how the pandemic that we're currently in got conversations started to look into inequities and things that communities have been facing for a long time. Did any of that come up in this 1918 pandemic? Was any of that noticed or, you know, changes made?
And there's two things that are really important about this. One is a way that 1918 is different from today, which is that in the 1918 pandemic, there was racial inequality, but it was actually less than was typical for the time. So in 1918, in cities, which is where we have the best data, non-white people had death rates that were 35% higher than white people, which is a lot. But in other years of that era, for flu and pneumonia deaths, it would be more like 133% higher, so more than twice as high. So 1918 was actually stood out as a time of relative equality because white populations were hit hard by the flu in a way that was actually somewhat unusual. And that was noted at the time. There were a lot of community efforts in Black populations to take the flu seriously, to encourage people to do things that would limit flu transmission. And it seems like that had an effect. And there's some other theories, too, about why those disparities might have been smaller. And some of my research is about that. But I also want to say something that is the same about the flu and today, which is that when I looked at 1918, the level of mortality is just incredibly high. Life expectancy dropped in 1 year from 51 to 39. And that kind of 12-year drop is really unprecedented. And so in my field of mortality demography, we really talk about 1918 as this completely unique experience that's unlike anything else. And there's something right about that. But what I learned is that white mortality during the 1918 flu pandemic was actually less than Black mortality had been every single prior year. That shocked me. And I then started to wonder, will that be true in the COVID pandemic as well? So we don't have the final data for 2020 yet, but I asked how many white people would have to die of the COVID pandemic in 2020 for white life expectancy last year to be the best that Black life expectancy has ever been. And the answer is between 700,000 and 1 million excess white deaths, which of course is more than actually happened. The upshot is in 1918 and again a century later now, what we think of as these really extreme mortality levels, in some sense, is what Black Americans experience every single year.
That's fascinating and very, very interesting. When will you be able to sort of wrap up your research about the numbers from the past year?
We're waiting for data from the federal government and for the final 2020 mortality statistics. And I expect we'd have it in the next couple of months.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and definitely interested in learning more about your research and what you come up with. So hopefully we'll catch up with you again soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Wrigley Field is a sociologist at the University of Minnesota. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can always find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.